Carlton Vaughan edits the news.
Good evening, everybody. I've spent this afternoon listening to the neutrality debate in the United States Senate. It's the first chance I've had to sit in on it, and the occasion was certainly interesting. They tell me it was one of the best days of the debate. One of the best because the speeches followed quickly upon one another, because there was a good deal of repartee back and forth, a good deal of exchange of sometimes rather bitter comment on the floor, and the men who participated were, most of them, competent speakers. And yet, I must say, one doesn't come away from an afternoon spent in listening to that debate with a particular enthusiasm for the process of democracy that is represented by this particular kind of an argument. And the reason is that most of the debate, to the listener, seems futile because he recognizes from the first, as he hears different men get up in the Senate chamber and argue about a particular amendment, that it's going to be defeated by a vote of perhaps 3-1. He sees that, he knows that, everybody on the floor knows it. Half the members of the Senate are walking about or are absent during this particular part of the debate because they know it too. It's just a matter of routine. And yet they go on and on and on discussing these amendments, which everybody knows are going to be beaten just as soon as they come down to the vote. Now, this particular amendment this afternoon that interested me was the one introduced by Senator La Follette, which provided that there was to be a referendum before the United States could declare war through the constitutional congressional procedure. It was to be only an advisory referendum, and this was introduced as an amendment to this Neutrality Act. Now, of course, it hasn't anything to do with this particular act. This particular act concerns the embargo, concerns the way in which we should or should not sell merchandise to foreign countries in time of war, and what we should do about declaring war ourselves or how we should declare it would seem to be rather foreign to the particular purpose of this debate. But of course, by our Senate procedure, you can introduce almost any kind of an amendment to this sort of a bill. And that's exactly what's been happening. And that's why the debate has dragged on and dragged on without anything of particular importance being brought forth. Now, today, there was even a 20-minute limitation. In effect, up to today, it's been an hour. Today, it dropped down to 20 minutes. And yet, as one listened to this discussion, I think almost everyone would have agreed that 5 minutes would have sufficed for any one of the men who spoke this afternoon to make practically every point that he succeeded finally in making in the course of a 20-minute talk. And so, it makes one wonder after an experience of that kind whether it's really true that the cure for the evils of democracy is more democracy. Perhaps it is true that the cure for some evils of democracy is a little less democracy of the particular kind that expresses itself in oratory. Now, this vote of 73-17, which finally killed this La Follette amendment, which was debated during the greater part of the afternoon, that probably would have been exactly the same if it had been taken 3 hours earlier. Now, what good was accomplished by 3 hours of debate on an amendment that was not germane to this particular bill? Well, maybe you can answer the question better than I've been able to answer it for myself. Senator Connolly, from where I sat, seemed to be the most entertaining speaker. Senator Norris seemed to be the most sincere, and Senator Barkley the most cogent in the discussion on this particular amendment. The most exciting incident of the afternoon that I witnessed came when Senator Clark of Missouri charged Senator Pittman of Nevada with pettifogging, and Senator Pittman promptly proceeded to rise upon his senatorial dignity and to say that Senator Clark was conceded, whereupon Senator La Follette rose and asked that both senators proceed in proper order, which they immediately did. I was impressed by the big map of Europe that was on the wall opposite the vice president's dais. It's the first time that I've seen a map of Europe in the United States Senate, and it indicated to me that Europe is coming closer to the United States all the time. The galleries were jammed today. People stood in line for hours without hardly a chance of getting in. Now, I've just had word from Al Warner down in the Senate that Senator Danaher of Connecticut has introduced another amendment. We were hoping that we might be able to give you the result of the vote on this particular broadcast, but it looks now as though it would probably be delayed, possibly for another hour. Senator Danaher's amendment proposes to use the term cash and carry instead of the term title and carry. Well, now, that's another pretty bit of phraseology about which learned United States senators can debate, I know, all night, if they like. And the Senate at this very moment is debating upon that particular matter of phraseology. The most notable contribution to the debate this afternoon, from the point of view of at least one spectator, was made by Senator Scott Lucas of Illinois, who announced just a few minutes ago that he would abandon 23 amendments which he had planned to introduce. The senators tell me that the vote's going to be 2-1 for lifting the embargo, whether that vote comes in 30 minutes or in 90 minutes. Senator Nye's attempt to substitute for the administration neutrality bill, his bill, which retains the embargo, was defeated today 67-22. This probably came nearest to being a real test of the final vote, although Senator Nye denies that it is really a true test. The vote on whether the United States is to ban armed merchant vessels and submarines from United States ports was defeated 65-26. That probably comes closer to being what the actual vote will be on the final, when the bill finally comes up for a decision. Today, there hasn't seemed to be a single item of real war news. I don't remember a day since the war began when there was absolutely nothing in the way of active fighting to report. The report from the Western Front indicates patrol activity, but nothing more. In Washington, there's a great deal of discussion as to the impingement of various aspects of the war on American policy. One question that's under discussion at the Navy Department now is the value of battleships. It was hinted today at the Navy Department that we may concentrate, for the next year at least, on fast cruisers and destroyers. The lessons of the European war are having their effect: the vulnerability of battleships to submarine attacks, the need for high-speed craft for convoy purposes, the fact that battleships did little fighting in the last World War and seem likely to do little in this, the enormous investment in one single unit that can be sunk by one single torpedo, all those things are factors in the calculation of battleship versus smaller ships. Neither the German nor the Russian government has made itself more popular with the American administration and the American people by the way in which the City of Flint episode has been handled. It was an excellent propaganda opportunity for both governments, but so far, they have certainly missed it. Berlin received word today that the city of Flint is en route to Hamburg from Murmansk, or rather is en route to some German port. It's in charge of a German prize crew, and the American crew is presumably on board. The chances are that the prize crew isn't large enough to operate the vessel alone, and that the American crew is being called upon to help, particularly the difficult navigation down the Norwegian coast, under conditions where they've got to watch out for every possible British ship. Now, if they confiscate the cargo of the city of Flint, the American government probably won't do anything about it. If they confiscate the ship, then the United States becomes an interested party because the United States Maritime Commission owns the ship. Now, the neutrality bill, if it is enacted tonight, will certainly change the situation so far as the operation of American ships in belligerent waters is concerned. And the city of Flint would not have been on this particular mission if that neutrality bill had been in effect before she sailed. United States Ambassador Steinhardt has had little luck in getting information about the city of Flint from the Soviet government. We haven't much ground for a protest because we don't know the whys and wherefores. We do know that the Soviet government has been stalling. The official Soviet news agency has been the first source of information as to what happened to the ship while it was at Murmansk. And usually, a diplomat interested in government action gets information ahead of the press, but not in Soviet Russia, so it seems. The city of Flint may be convoyed by German submarines. That's the hint from Berlin. Of course, that hint may be issued to frighten off British ships, which might try to recapture the ship from the Germans. And then again, the Germans may decide to sink her rather than give her up. President Roosevelt was again asked about the third term today. A reporter quoted another reporter who had written about Vice President Garner, "He's riding high and going straight, he's headed for the White House gate." Well, that pretty little piece of poetry did not get much response from the president. He told his inquirer that his press conference should confine itself to news, which brings up the interesting question as to what is news. When Secretary of the Interior Ickes came out for the third term, that was news. When Secretary of Agriculture Wallace came out for the third term, that was news. Certainly, if the president had quoted Calvin Coolidge by saying, "I do not choose to run," that would have been news. Or if he had quoted Theodore Roosevelt about being willing to accept a third cup of coffee, that would have been news. And most editors may even think that there is news in the fact that President Roosevelt refused to give out any news about the third term. I'm told that the Washington correspondents are still very much divided on whether President Roosevelt wants a third term, will ask for a third term, or can get a third term. All of which argues the president's success in hiding his intentions. This, however, is true. Friends of certain other Democratic candidates are now whispering that FDR doesn't want a third term and is only waiting for the right time to say so. Today, the Pope of Rome spoke out on behalf of peace and on behalf of decency in government. He did it in issuing the first encyclical of his pontificate. "It is quite true," he said, "that power based on weak and unsteady foundations can attain at times under chance circumstances. Material success is apt to arouse wonder in superficial observers. But the moment comes when the inevitable law triumphs, which strikes down all that has been constructed upon a hidden or open disproportion between the greatness of the material and outward success and the weakness of the inward value. Safety," he said, "does not come to peoples from external means, from the sword, which can impose conditions of peace, but which does not create peace." Good night.